Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today is Professor of Buddhism in the Department of Comparative Religion and Humanities at California State University, Chico. Daniel Weilinger received his Ph.D. from the Department of South Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. His first book explored the origins of the oral traditions of India. Today I'll be asking Professor Weilinger about Buddhism along the Silk Road in his book From Indra's Net to Internet, Communication, Technology, and the Evolution of Buddhist Ideas. He examines how Buddhist ideas are being accepted by people who immerse themselves in the online world. Welcome, Professor Weilinger.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I was wondering how people might like to know that when you were younger, you went to a summer camp that was also attended by one of my favorite radio personalities, Ira Glass.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, so I grew up in Toronto, Canada, and I'm from a Jewish family. In fact, my grandfather was a rabbi in that area. And I had a very strong Jewish identity growing up. And I went to many people in the Jewish community in Eastern Canada, as well as Northeast United States, go to Jewish summer camps during the summer. And I went to one of them. And there's a number of them, and it's a whole world of different summer camps there, and each one is connected to a different kind of Judaism. So one will be more religious, one will be more conservative, one will be completely kind of irreligious but culturally Jewish. So I went to one called Camp Gesher, which was part of a labor Zionist organization. So it was kind of a left-wing socialist, but also had a Zionist bent to it. And a number of famous people, there were a few camps that were part of this group. So I didn't go to the same actual camp that Ira Glass went to. He went to our sister camp near Chicago. Then there's Seth Rogen also went to that camp in Vancouver. So a number. Oh, and also in South Africa, Sacha Baron Cohen went to the camp as well in England. So there's a number of people who went to this camp.
Well, that was pretty important in your growing up. The summer camp.
Oh, yes, definitely. I really feel that I kind of came to be the person that I am through the summer camp because we had so many activities. It wasn't just about having fun. I mean, we had canoeing. The canoes were mostly leaky. And we had water skiing, and the boat's engine wasn't quite strong enough to pull us. But nevertheless, we also had lots of activities where we talked about our values and we talked about society. And I learned many of the ideas that I still have today from that summer camp. So definitely, and I made friends that I'm still friends with today through that summer camp. It was a very formative experience in my life, for sure.
My guest is Daniel Weilinger, and I asked him about his growing up because you started out, Daniel, mm-hmm. As a physics major.
Right.
And you were a good student, mm-hmm. So it wasn't that physics was difficult for you, but how did you become disillusioned with physics?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm glad you asked that. So when I went to the summer camp, this is again connected to summer camp, I was friends with what I guess today would be called the geeks, right? Like there were a few of us, there were some guys who were the jocks and they were kind of the big sporty guys. At the summer camp, I was not one of them. I was more of the geek community. And, we would all, instead of going to the dance on Saturday nights, we would sit around and do physics problems for fun, right? And we would see who can guess, who can triangulate this or that calculation. And so we all ended up going into physics in our respective universities when we went to university. And it was just kind of what you did when you were part of my group. And of course, we listened to Monty Python sketches and we liked Rush, the band, and all these kinds of things that are stereotypically done by people who are interested in these things. And we were very curious. So again, at the summer camp at night, we would sit and stare at the stars and wonder, is there a God? What happens after you die? We had very stereotypically teenage discussions, but they were actually quite deep. And we'd seriously discuss the nature of life and death and reincarnation, these kinds of questions. So when I went to university, I was split between an interest in physics and science and an interest in these more metaphysical questions. And I kind of thought that science might help me answer some of the metaphysical questions. But exactly as you asked, I did kind of get disillusioned, because what ended up happening was, instead of late night discussions about, you know, is there a God or not in the science classes, what ended up happening was a lot of just rote memorization of formulas. And I just felt that that wasn't giving me the kind of knowledge that I wanted. And, you know, every week I would say, okay, next week we're going to talk about the meaning behind all this stuff. And we never did. It was just more memorization and more formulas and more memorization. And a discussion of the meaning behind these things. You know, why is the universe like this? Why does gravity operate? Not just memorizing the code to calculate gravitational pull, but, you know, what is it? Why is it? These were never actually answered. And then I took an elective course in religious studies, Introduction to Eastern Religions, and it was just fascinating, you know, and it covered all of those questions that I wanted to learn about in university. And then I just decided, you know what, I think I'm going to switch majors to religious studies instead of physics. So that's how it happened.
My guest is Daniel Weidlinger, and he is telling us about how he decided to go from physics, study of physics, to the study of comparative religions. One other thing, Daniel, I have to mention when you were younger, because here in Chico, I know this young man just finished high school. He's tall and slender, and he plays bass guitar.
Yes, well, boy, you did a lot of research. I do indeed, yes. So the two biggest influences on my life, even up to today, you know, so it's interesting. Sometimes as you get older, you look back on your life and say, I can't believe I did all these silly things when I was a teenager, you know. But I look back and I say, you know what? I was kind of right about a lot of things, you know. So one is just my whole social values that I got from my kind of socially active Jewish summer camp. And another one is the values I got from my band. So I was deeply into music, and I listened to what is called progressive rock. So that's the kind of rock music that combines classical music with rock music, and some of the more well-known bands that play this are, like Genesis is part of this movement, and King Crimson is another one. And the idea is that they said that you shouldn't just go and, you know, not learn your instrument and just turn it really loud and start playing. But rather, you should study music. You should try to get good at your instrument, because they saw rock music as more than just a rebellion against, you know, adults, but exploring music itself for music's sake. So I was into that movement. So I studied a lot of music, and I learned to read music and, of course, play music. And then, of course, the lyrics were expected not to be about, you know, boy meets girl, boy loves girl, boy loses girl. It was more about, again, the nature of the universe, how many dimensions are there, what happens if you get sucked into a black hole, these kinds of things. So the lyrics that we wrote for my band took a lot of time and effort, and we would read classical literature. Famously, we did a whole rock opera version of Virgil's Aeneid as a project. It was like about a two-hour-long rock opera. So that also introduced me to religion through that door as well, but through the door of music, using mythology as the basis for our lyrics. So that's another entree into religion that I got from my teenage years.
My guest is Daniel Weidlinger, and he is a professor of Buddhism at California State University, Chico. And your book that I wanted to talk to you about today is called From Indra's Net to Internet. And just for those who might not understand that title,
right?
Who is Indra and what is Indra?
Yes, good. So when I thought of the title, I thought it was so good, it must be taken already. And I did some research, and it wasn't taken, so I was happy to use it. So in Buddhism, well, I should say in India, one of the great gods is called Indra, and he dates all the way back to Vedic times, as you probably know. And he's basically the Zeus equivalent in India, the king of the gods. And in some myths, one of the ways that he makes the world is by spreading a net. So the world is not just a bunch of solid things all existing independently, but rather everything is interconnected. And that's a key idea that one finds in many Indian religions, Hinduism and Buddhism included. And I will just make a quick side note. I'm also director of the Humanities Center at the California State University, Chico. And each year we organize a series of talks on a particular theme. And the theme for this year is the environment. And I've been learning a lot about the environment through running this theme. I didn't choose the theme myself, but I'm just the director, so I'm running it. And it's really important to understand the interconnection of all things that we see in the environment, because as people know from reading the news today, we're suffering severe problems in the environment. And unless you understand that everything is all connected to each other, that nothing is independent, you won't really understand how fragile the environment is. So getting back to Indra's net, in India, there's an idea that the whole universe is a web of interconnected things. So they view it as a kind of net. And Indra is the god who made the net and who kind of holds the net in his hands. And the Indra's net image is that at each node where the different pieces of web cross each other, there's a diamond there. And in that diamond is reflected all the other diamonds from all the other parts of the net. So each part can be seen through each of the other parts. So that's the image of Indra's net. And since it sounds like internet, I thought I would use that because both of them, of course, talk about bringing things together and being able to, I mean, from any node, right, go to any computer terminal, think of that as a node in the net, you can see all the other parts of the net because you can just look at whatever's on the net anywhere from that one computer.
My guest is Professor Daniel Weidlinger, author of From Indra's Net to Internet. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Professor Daniel Weidlinger, who writes about Buddhism along the Silk Road. I might give the rest of the title, From Indra's Net to Internet, Communication, Technology, and the Evolution of Buddhist Ideas. Now, several times we've mentioned Buddhism, but in your title is Buddhist Ideas. And I notice you make the point in your book that, well, in one part you have a topic, what is Buddhism?
Right.
And can you answer that for us?
Right. So this is a very deep problem that we have in Buddhist studies, which is, what is Buddhism? Because I've met a lot of people who tell me that they're Buddhist. And what exactly that means, I don't know. I should say a lot of people in America who appear to come from a non-Asian background and tell me that they're Buddhist. And what that exactly means is somewhat unclear. Often what it means, most often what it seems to mean, is that they've read some books about Buddhism and they found them really inspiring and they see and they use those books to help them in their life. We often use the term nightstand Buddhists. In other words, a Buddhist who reads a lot about Buddhism as they're going to bed and they then feel that it's influenced their lives enough that they can call themselves a Buddhist. And this is beyond Buddhism, just the idea of who is any religion is a deep question in religious studies. And there's all sorts of debates about who gets to be called what. It's not just who's a Buddhism, but who's a Muslim, who's a Jew, who's anything. I like to think that you are what you say you are. So if you say you're a Buddhist, that's fine for me. However, to distinguish these kinds of ideas of Buddhism from the formal religion of Buddhism itself, I wanted to use the term Buddhist ideas in the book because I'm not so concerned with the institutionalized religion of Buddhism, but rather the progress of various key ideas that are associated with Buddhism through time and through different media technologies. So that's why I specifically said Buddhist ideas, to clarify that.
Well, you know, I sometimes get the question, because of my interest in yoga, am I a Buddhist?
Right, yes, I'm sure
and
you do.
I say, I don't know enough about it because the friends that I have that are Buddhist, they study all the time. They're having groups and they're in their sangha. And I feel like I don't know enough to be a Buddhist.
Oh, yes, I know. Like you, as a professor of Buddhism, I, of course, get asked, am I Buddhist, all the time. And, you know, at the end of every course, I say, okay, now, is there any question you have that we haven't covered in the class? And it's always
and the hands go up.
Are you Buddhist? That's all they want to know. Am I Buddhist? And, of course, I never answer the question because I don't like to present my own points of view. But I can tell the listeners that obviously some key ideas of Buddhism are a deep influence on me. I wouldn't have dedicated my life to studying something I thought was completely wrong. But, you know, I don't like to say whether I am a Buddhist or not, although, of course, I am influenced by a lot of the ideas.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who practice other religions who don't realize that some of their practices came from Buddhism.
Oh, yes. This is a very interesting point. There's a lot of ideas and practices in many religions, Western religions and Eastern ones, that may have come from Buddhism or other Indian religions over time. This is one of the themes of my book, is that there was a lot more communication in the ancient world than people often realize. Like the ancient Greeks knew a little bit about Buddhism, for example. Most people are kind of surprised to hear about that. And in fact, in India, there have been many findings of Roman coins buried in India, which is a long way off from Rome, if you think about it. But when there's coinage, it means there must have been people to bring the coins there. My understanding is that the farthest from Rome they've ever found a cache of Roman-era coins is actually in Vietnam. I'm pretty sure that that's the case, which is pretty far from Rome. But the point is that the Romans who made it there would have known about a little bit about Buddhism, and there were some Buddhist there are some similar ideas in some of the Roman era religions and Greek era philosophies, like Stoicism, for example. And there's all sorts of debate as to whether Buddhism influenced it or whether it's a kind of coincidence. And you know, we don't exactly know, but the point is, yes, there are lots of ideas that are similar. I wouldn't necessarily say they come from, because we're not 100% sure where, but often there's a lot of similarity, and if we know Buddhism was first, it's very possible that it did come from. But I wouldn't, as a scholar, necessarily say that until we have further direct evidence. But yeah, it suggests that it may have come from there for sure.
My guest is Daniel Weidinger, and his book is From Indrasnet to Internet: Communication, Technology, and the Evolution of Buddhist Ideas. Well, there's a practice in Catholicism for a long time, very popular in the Middle Ages, and I participated, even though I'm not Catholic, I made a pilgrimage, walked across Spain to the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela, where the bones of St. James are buried.
Uh-huh.
And in Buddhism, they made pilgrimages to sacred sites where saints, I don't know if I'll call them saints, were buried.
Right. Well, that's a practice that, again, exactly what we were just talking about, that we know that Buddhism is the first major religion that has recorded traditions of pilgrimage to the remains of sacred people. That's pretty much for sure. Because, of course, Judaism is older than Buddhism, but they didn't have, that kind of behavior towards human beings. So Buddhism certainly was first. And whether those ideas came from Buddhism is unclear, although the techniques and the manner in which relics are preserved are so remarkably similar between some of the Christian traditions and Buddhism that a lot of people have wondered whether they got those ideas from Buddhism. And of course, the monkhood as well. I mean, the Buddhist monkhood and the various rules of living as a monk were well established in Buddhism, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years before the first Christian monks started. And the Christian monastic tradition probably started in the Egypt area, which was, a lot closer to India and South Asia than other parts of Christendom. So there may very well have been some sort of influence that went from Buddhism to to the Middle East and then through to the European Christian tradition in terms of both the relics and the pilgrimages and the monastic tradition?
Well, the similarities, I might say, of what the Buddha said, go out and tell other people about this.
Right.
Sounds familiar, too.
Absolutely. Well, we often think of Buddhism actually as the world's first proselytizing religion. So before Buddhism, and this is mentioned in the book because it ties into the whole development of communication and transportation, but before Buddhism, most religions were more tribal in nature, right? So the various gods were meant to be gods of one particular area. So if you were in Athens, you worshipped, well, Athena. And if you were in various Middle Eastern areas, you might have worshipped Marduk or whatever the local Baal or the local god would have been. But in India during the Buddhist time, and the Buddhist time, just to be clear for those listening who don't know, was probably around 500 BC, around that period. We don't know exactly, but around that. So during the Buddhist time, he was one of the first to really explicitly say that my religion is meant for everybody. This is not a local religion where you have to believe in this local god, and then if you move to another area, then, you know, naturally you would start to worship their local god. No, my religion is meant for everybody, and he instructed his followers to spread it far and wide. And he was quite successful at doing that. Buddhism, of course, now is found all over the world, in America as well as Asia. And there's no doubt that one of the reasons for him saying this is the beginnings of more sophisticated means of transportation and of communication that happened during the Buddha's time. Because in really ancient times, when humans lived in isolated communities, the idea of spreading the religion wouldn't be there simply because people didn't spread anything, right? Most people lived in a small tribal area, and they didn't really have that much communication with people living in far off other places. So the idea would never arisen. During the Buddha's time, you know, better roads started to be made, the wheels started to get used, at least in that area, and therefore the idea of spreading the religion to begin with would have emerged.
Now, you just mentioned wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was rather surprised at my own ignorance that I thought, well, duh, look at the flag of India.
Yes, right.
What is on the flag of India?
Yeah. So the flag of India has a Dharma chakra, a wheel of Dharma in the middle of it. And that wheel is the symbol of Buddhism, or one of the symbols of Buddhism. And the main king of India was called King Ashoka, who lived around 250 BC. And he was the first king, just like in Christendom, if you know, Christianity was also a small persecuted group for the first few hundred years. Then the Roman Emperor Constantine in around 320, he officially recognizes the main religion of the Roman Empire, and then it became a huge world religion. So in the same way, Buddhism, as I said, Buddha might have been 500 BC. So for a similar period of time, maybe 200 or 300 years, Buddhism was a small group. And then this King Ashoka became Buddhist and helped to spread Buddhism all over India and then later the world. And he built pillars at the center of the main towns of his empire. And on top of the pillar, he had a stone carving of this wheel. And the pillars had inscriptions telling people to be kind to each other, to be kind to animals, to be compassionate towards all beings, basic Buddhist ideas. And they were topped by this pillar with the wheel. And there's various meanings behind the symbol of the wheel. One of them, of course, is simply rebirth, right? That life is a wheel. It keeps on turning, and when we die, we're reborn. And that became the symbol of India, in fact. And there was some controversy about it because it is kind of associated with Buddhism specifically. But nevertheless, it was recognized that Ashoka didn't just spread Buddhism. He also was the first king to unite all of India together. So that's why it was chosen as the symbol.
My guest is Daniel Weidlinger, and he is a professor of Buddhism at Chico State University. And his book is From Indra's Net to Internet. And on the cover of your book, there's a circle with a pair of bare feet, and there's that wheel you've just been talking about. So what is the significance of this little symbol on the cover of your book?
So I'm glad that you're asking very interesting questions that different ones than I've been asked previously. So when the Buddha died, he entered a state of bliss called nirvana, or well, parinirvana. I'm sure that the listeners have heard about nirvana, not the band, but the state of being. So briefly, the state of nirvana is a state in which we have no desires and therefore no suffering. Right, so that's one of the key ideas of Buddhism, is to conquer your desires. That when we have desires, we want this, we want that, they're inevitably frustrated, right? You never get something and then you're happy for the rest of your life because of that one thing, right? We want more, we want more. So you'll only ever be happy if you conquer all of your desires and you're just happy with whatever you have, right? You might have a lot and then you'll be happy, and you might have a little and you'll be happy. So you conquer your desires. That's called being in nirvana. But then you're still alive. When you die and you have no desires, then you enter a state called parinirvana, or full nirvana, in which, and there's great debate about what the state of parinirvana is, but basically you have no desires and you have no body, and basically you have no consciousness. So it's like a blissful, eternal state of being. It's kind of like the Buddhist ultimate goal, kind of like heaven, except that you don't have consciousness in heaven, right? You're not flying around like as an angel. You don't meet long-dead relatives there. You just kind of exist in a blissful state of pure being. At any rate, the problem is that once you enter that state, you can't hear anything. You can't see anything. So when the Buddha enters that state, he can't hear anything. He's just like pure blissful existence. But that means if you pray to the Buddha, how can he answer your prayer? Because he can't hear you, right? So if he can't hear or see anything, or he's not conscious of anything, if you pray to him, what'll happen? So this was a big question that arose in Buddhism. So one of the principles in Buddhist iconography was, and stop me if I'm going into this in too much depth, but I just want the listeners to understand the basis for this. So one of the principles in Buddhist iconography was not to portray the Buddha in statue form. So after he died, because he's not, I guess there was a worry that if you made statues of the Buddha, then people would think psychologically from seeing the statue that that means that the Buddha is in some sense still around, that you can still pray to the Buddha and he will answer your prayers. You know, he's a kind of godlike being, which he's not supposed to be, right? He's simply supposed to be not a god, but a guide. Not a god, but a guide, right? That you follow his way and you can reach nirvana too. So instead of portraying the Buddha in statue form, what they did was they carved his feet. And that's what you see on the cover of my book. It's the foot of the Buddha. So it's supposed to say, okay, the feet will make you think of the Buddha because you want to think of his teachings. But it's better than a statue of the full body, which, as we know from human psychology, right, there is a deep tendency in humans to kind of want to worship people that we think are, in some ways, have achieved great things. So by not making a statue of the Buddha, the temptation to worship that statue would be weakened. But you had to have something to remind people of the Buddha, so they decided to carve his feet. And of course, they carved that Dharma wheel into his feet to represent that, you know, he was the Buddha. So that, you know, it's just not anybody's feet, but the Buddha's feet. So that's what's on my book. Now, as you will well know, anybody who's been to Asia knows this, over time, they did in fact start making statues of the Buddha. And in the Middle Ages, probably the single most commonly made item on the face of the earth was a statue of the Buddha. So these the feet that are on my book were discarded after a few hundred years. And then they said, oh, let's just make statues. And they did.
After a break, Professor Weidlinger and I will continue our conversation about how Buddhist ideas are being accepted by people who immerse themselves in the online world. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North Sea Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with the author of From Indra's Net to the Internet, Professor of Buddhism Daniel Weidlinger. And one of the features of your book is the Silk Road.
Right.
What a mysterious, exotic thing this is. What is the Silk Road, Daniel?
So the Silk Road was not one road, but really a series of trade routes. So it wasn't an actual road, although some parts were obviously prepared in ways that were easier to transmit.
Because you do say in your book that it's known somewhat inaccurately as the Silk Road.
Right. It's really the Silk Routes would be. Routes is a better word than road. It's a route that travelers took because it was well known how to use it. So the Silk Road was a very long series of routes that went from China in the east. There were two main cities in ancient China. There's Luoyang and Chang'an. They were the two capitals of China. The capital moved from one to the other of those cities, depending on which dynasty it was at. And it went all the way through Central Asia, just north of India, then through the Middle East, all the way into Syria. And in fact, one of the kind of ends was in western Syria, along the Mediterranean, in towns like, I forget if the Palmyra, I believe, was one of the end routes, and that was a city that a few years ago under ISIS was largely destroyed, and many of the monuments there were destroyed. Then it also went through Turkey and right into Europe itself. So it was a way that basically started during the Roman times, maybe second century, something like that. Then those routes continued for hundreds and hundreds of years and really was only replaced in the, let's say in the 14th, 15th centuries, once the seafaring navigation took over, right? So as you know, everybody knows that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And what was he trying to do? He was trying, well, this is actually a very common misunderstanding. Most people think that Columbus was trying to find a shorter route to India, right? But that makes it seem like Europeans were going to India already all the time, but they were just taking a kind of long route and Columbus wanted to find a short route. But in fact, he was trying to find any sea route to India. I mean, there was the Silk Road that you could use, but there was not a sea route. Like, they were not going down underneath Africa and around before Columbus, and he decided, well, maybe if we went around west, it would be shorter. He was just trying to find any way to get to India, and of course, he didn't. But Vasco da Gama got to India a few years later, and he went, you know, the regular way, like down under Africa and then up through the Indian Ocean into India. So once all that stuff started, then the Silk Road started to die out because it's just a lot easier to transmit a lot of heavy goods on a ship than it is on camels. But yeah, so for at least 1,000 years, the Silk Road was the main road that was used to get from Chang'an in China through to the Roman Empire. And the Chinese did know about the Romans. They didn't know that much, but they did know that there was like a big empire to the west of them. And the Romans knew a little bit about the Chinese, but, you know, not that much. But they weren't completely separated as people might think. And then, of course, Marco Polo in the 13th century that many people have probably heard of traveled all the way. What I should point out that most of the route was not traveled by one person. So it wouldn't be one person starts in, let's say, Venice, Italy, which was a common endpoint, and then travels all the way through to Chang'an. He might go to Palmyra, you know, a few weeks to get there, and then somebody else will go from there to Iran, and somebody else will take the goods, you know, kind of like a relay. But some people did individually travel the whole route. And it took a fair bit of time. Maybe a year and a half is the kind of time span that I've heard to get from a place like Venice, which was a major trading center, all the way through to China. Something like a year and a half, just to give people a basic idea. So it was, you know, a long way, and then back again. So maybe 3 years there and back.
Well, now, what is the role of the Silk Road in your point about Indra's net to internet?
So I like to call the Silk Road the internet of the ancient world. One thing about the internet is that it's a very efficient way of getting information from one place to another over great distances. I mean, you might remember, you know, just like I do, that when we were younger, before the internet, let's say you heard about Buddhism, something that in, you know, might not have been as popular as it is now. And you say, well, what is that? And just to find out what it is was not that easy. You know, you'd have to go to a library.
An encyclopedia.
Yes, exactly. So you might find an encyclopedia with a shorter article. But, you know, the amount of information that is available now on the internet is absolutely astronomical. And we can access information from China, from Africa, from Brazil, wherever we want it to be, at a moment's notice. Now, the Silk Road, of course, silk was one of the main items that was transported because silk is very light and very expensive. So that's what you, when it takes you a year and a half and you've just got a few camels to do it, they can't carry all that much. So you've got to
and
make it worth
your while.
You might
even put silkworms in your hair.
Yes, exactly. The Chinese were very, very careful about letting people get silkworms out of China. And right, so there's all sorts of legends about people who snuck them out in their hair to get it. But so, yeah, so silk was kind of a monopoly in China for a long time. Therefore, it was extremely expensive and extremely light. So it's the perfect thing. If you're going to take a journey, you're not going to take something heavy like an anvil, right, which is something that's very heavy and very cheap. So why on earth would you want to carry it for a year and a half over the mountains, over the desert, just to get, you know, $10 for it? So there would be caravans that would go through the Silk Road, and often religious teachers, mostly Buddhists, but also from other religions, would tag along with the merchant groups on the Silk Road and go. And often the merchants would be happy because they would say, well, you know, the more religious people we have with us, I guess the safer it'll be, right? Because they'll figure that whatever gods are the ones that are real, at least if we have like a Buddhist monk with us, we've got a Christian, we've got a Manichaean, which was another old religion that's not around anymore. Well, one of them will keep us safe. So the merchants were happy usually to keep. And also they would regale them with tales. I mean, you know, it's a long time to just be walking for a year to get there. So if you have somebody who's learned, that was actually a great value to you because he could just tell you about the religion and his teachings along the way. So the merchants were happy to take them. And then, of course, they would stop in towns along the way. So just like the railways in America or the interstates, towns would develop at crossroads, and they would have services, inns and restaurants and stuff like that. So the same thing happened in the Silk Road. And they would stop in these towns. And naturally, people in the town would be excited to see the foreigners coming, and they would all gather around, and they would stay a few days to replenish, and they would talk to the people in the town and share their ideas with them. And that's how a lot of the teachings of Buddhism and other religions spread. So it's kind of like the internet. I mean, it took a year instead of a second, but still it was better than nothing, right? So before the Silk Road, it was really hard to get from, you know, Europe to China. So to get any of the ideas either from Europe to China or from China to Europe was not easy. The Silk Road made it not easy, but at least possible. And in that sense, it was kind of like an internet of its day. So I look at in the book the flourishing of Buddhist ideas along the Silk Road.
Well, I wondered if people listening to your listing the religions along the way, and there's one major religion that you didn't mention, and people might say, but I thought Islam was big there.
Right. So one of the things that I deal with in the book is the connection between Buddhism and Islam along the Silk Road. So just to be clear, the Silk Road, as I said, started in China, and there were two major cities there, Luoyang and Chang'an. And it went through just north of India. It didn't go through exactly India. In fact, one of the stops was Bamiyan in Afghanistan. And some people might remember that just before 9/11, in the year 2000, the Taliban actually destroyed two of the largest statues of any kind on earth. They were two statues of the Buddha, about 180 feet tall, each one. And that was a major center along the Silk Road where people would stop just as they kind of got over the mountains from China. And anyway, so a good chunk of the Silk Road runs through what we call Central Asia. The countries now, so we have Afghanistan, we have Uzbekistan, and countries like that, a bit of Kazakhstan. So also Xinjiang, which is in the news a lot lately. Listeners might have heard about it because that's in northwest China, where a group of people called the Uyghurs live. And they are a Muslim people that were a major presence along the Silk Road. So a good chunk of the Silk Road was in the Xinjiang area. And nowadays, there's a lot of pressure on the Uyghur Muslims of Xinjiang to abandon Islam. And you might have heard that in the news, there's a lot of reports about forced the Chinese are calling it re-education camps, right, where they are educated to learn that, you know, religion is a damaging thing and they should abandon their religion. So it's a very difficult situation. I do urge listeners to look into what's going on there. So the point is that these major areas, Uzbekistan, Xinjiang, Afghanistan, are of course now Muslim. So what happened to Buddhism along that area? And many people are surprised to learn that the major religion in these areas in the kind of early Middle Ages was Buddhism. So before Islam came there, many of these people were Buddhist. Afghanistan was probably the major center in the world of Buddhism. And people don't realize that there's a very rich history in these areas and there's been a lot of change. When one hears about, you know, the things going on in Afghanistan, of course, it's in the news today. And often people say, well, you know, they live in their tribal ways as they have for thousands of years and it's difficult to bring change. But people don't realize that that area has undergone huge amounts of change from time immemorial. They had all sorts of religions. Then they had Buddhism. Now they have Islam. So Buddhism was very common in these areas, but over time, Islam came to take over. Now, the form of Islam that became quite popular along the Silk Road areas, let's say in the 12th, 13th, 14th century, that were previously Buddhist, is a form called Sufism. And Sufism is what we call a mystical version of Islam, in which they focus a lot on the unity of all things. As people might know, in Islam, one of the core ideas is that there's only one God. And Sufis believe that not only is there one God, but there may only be one thing, and that thing is God, that God permeates all things. And this is a kind of debatable topic as to whether God's presence is everywhere or only in the heavens, but we don't have to get into theological debate. The point is that in Sufism, there was a kind of belief in God's presence everywhere, which is a kind of mystical idea. And there's an emphasis on compassion above all things. And Sufism is a very non-punitive form of Islam, right? So the thing that many listeners might have heard about that goes on in some of the more conservative Islamic areas nowadays, where there's, you know, very strict punishments for disobeying the laws, this kind of stuff was not known in the Sufi form of Islam. And a lot of the Buddhist ideas that one might have found there kind of molded into some of the Islamic ideas. So it wasn't like a sudden change. It was a gradual change from Buddhism to a kind of Sufi form of Islam. Then over time, the Islam became a little bit more strict in some of those areas. So now, like literally right now, there's tension between the remnants of the Sufi tradition there and the more strict, what we call Wahhabi forms of Islam in those regions.
You know, you make the point in your book that a growing group of people consider themselves spiritual but not religious. Right. And I would think things like the Sufi point of view would appeal to people like this because it seems a spiritual emphasis. And you make the point, too, that Jews and Christians meditating nowadays, our very own Enlow Medical Center offers mindfulness stress reduction. So we've got people meditating. It's mainstream now. It's not relegated to these strange people who call themselves Buddhist.
Yes. And there's been a lot of discussion about this. And this ties into what you had said earlier about some practices people that people are doing in their own religions. I know that, like in San Francisco, I drove by a church and it said, you know, meditation session Wednesday nights and whatnot. People might not realize that, yeah, there seem to be Buddhist roots to a lot of these traditions. Now, for sure, in Christianity, Islam, Judaism, there have been meditative traditions from within their own tradition from time immemorial. I think that that's very clear. But they were always kind of peripheral, you know, and not something that a lot of people were doing. But combining some of the Buddhist insights about meditation with some of the, let's call them the seeds of meditation, right? So in some of these traditions, now in the last 20 years has kind of given birth to a very robust meditation tradition that one finds in many of these religions. But certainly whatever the seeds of it might have been in their own religions, a good chunk of it, if not the bulk of it, has kind of come through Buddhism that has been brought to the rest of the world by various teachers over time. But of course, the name Buddhism gets dropped. So yeah, mindfulness-based stress reduction is Buddhism. It's just that, in order to spread it to the common person, it's better not to emphasize the Buddhist. But it's not like a secret form of Buddhism they're trying to, sneak in so that people don't realize it. It's a technique that was discovered by Buddhism, but it can be abstracted from Buddhism. So yeah, let's be clear about that. I'm not saying that they're trying to make people Buddhist without saying so. They have abstracted the non-religious aspects of the tradition and turned it into a mindfulness thing. But the roots of it, I should say, do seem to come from Buddhism.
And so much of the time, we hear stories about the bad influence. People go online and then they commit all these atrocities. And yet you quote somebody named Pinker, we're not getting more violent or more intolerant as a result that we spend time online, but far more accepting of difference and less willing to use violence to solve our problems than ever before. So I loved hearing that, Daniel.
Yeah, yes, I know. In this day and age, people say, what? The internet is, pulling people to the lowest common denominator. It is injecting hatred and violence into our speech for sure, and maybe even our behavior. I hear this a lot. So the book is basically divided into two main parts, right? There's the pre-modern part that looks at the Silk Road and how ideas were transmitted along the Silk Road. Then there's the modern part that looks at the internet and how ideas are transmitted along the internet. And one of my main arguments is indeed that the use of the internet and social media and these kinds of things are making people less violent, more understanding of each other. However, what it does is it does emphasize the problems that we're having in a way that we might not have noticed before. So like has always been a key idea in the news, right? If it bleeds, it leads. If something is bad, if it involves hatred, if it involves violence, then they push it up to the front. And human psychology is like that too. So even when it's not a news editor deciding that, if you have groups like Reddit or whatever where people rate stories, it also gets pushed up to the front because it's just more interesting. Nobody wants to read headlines. Everybody loves each other today, right? So it might appear as if things are getting worse. It's just like the shark attack thing, right? People are afraid of sharks because they're worried that they'll get eaten by a shark. But the fact is, like, 70 people a year are attacked by sharks around the world, and that's absolutely nothing. Apparently something like 7 million sharks are killed by human beings a year, right? But, it's sensational, so you think there's sharks everywhere, but in fact there's not. So it's the same sort of thing. If you really do a deep study, Steven Pinker has done a similar one that you just mentioned, and I've done one. If you do a deep study of all the data, it's very clear that a society is becoming more tolerant, becoming more understanding. People are turning to violence less often to solve problems than they have before. And I know it sometimes sounds surprising. But, well, we just had the Academy Awards last week. And as you know, one of the films, 1917, about World War I, was up for a nomination. So just think about this. In World War I, there were many days, when 20 or 30,000 soldiers died in a day, right? And there were many. That wasn't like the worst day. This would happen day after day. And those are the kinds of wars that people used to fight. And World War I wasn't even about issues in the same way that World War II was, about a serious problem. It was just about, posturing for control and stuff. So when you think about that, and then you look at the world today, you realize, well, maybe things aren't actually as bad as we sometimes make it out to be. And if you look at the amount of people helping each other, the amount of people supporting each other and support groups online, which is, a lot of it is private discussion. People might have a difficulty of some sort, a marital difficulty or a psychological difficulty, and there's all sorts of online forums. And of course, it's not made public because the whole point is you're kind of discussing with other members of the forum. But people get great help and in ways that they never would have before. Just look at the amount of support there is for the various movements. We have the Black Lives Matter, of course, the Me Too movement, all sorts of movements where people are saying, what's being done to people all this time has been wrong. And that for sure would not have happened without the internet.
Well, I liked a quote in your book. This is not about this book in particular, but you say you had an experience that led me to feel even more strongly that a humanities education can prepare one for far more than just academia. So you had the opportunity to see management felt that I had performed better than any of the other employees and that my knowledge of how to think, if not the specific content of my knowledge, was a great asset. So you had practical experience that a background in the humanities is not a route to unemployment.
Yes, certainly not. This is an interest of mine, is explaining to people that there is a lot of opportunity in the world for people with a good humanities training to succeed in the world. And I've had a number of interesting jobs over the years, and I felt, and people about me felt, that I performed very well or even better than some people who are maybe more trained specifically for that thing. Because, you know, the world is changing so quickly, right? And if you have a broad view of history and of language and culture and these kinds of things, it really makes you a much better employee in many ways. And of course, if there's some specific job, I mean, maybe not neurosurgery, right? You want to be trained for that. But a lot of jobs, you can get training on the job that'll make you good at that job. But the kind of person who you are when you step in the door to work at that place is more important than the specific knowledge that you have of the job. So humanities really helps people to think critically, to think creatively, and to get along with others. As we also know, especially in California, but in other places in the world too, as the world gets smaller, as people from different cultures and backgrounds, and again, I say California because it's one of the most diverse places probably in the whole world, are working together. If you know a little bit about the culture of that person or the religion or the history, it makes them open up to you in ways you can't imagine. And you just get along better with your coworkers. Let's say you might be working with somebody from India, somebody from China. And if you've taken a course on, you know, intro to Indian culture or Chinese religion or whatever it may be, and you just say to somebody, you know, happy Chinese New Year to you, or, oh, it's, you know, it's Holi from India today, I hear, and I hope you enjoy throwing the colors on each other, and say, how did you know we do that? And like it opened and you become friends, and you just, you have a much better work environment. And sometimes that's better than any specific knowledge that you might have about, you know, this financial regulation or that, which you can always learn later.
Well, thank you, Professor of Humanities, Daniel Weidlinger.
Thank you.
His book is From Indrasnet to Internet, Communication, Technology, and the Evolution of Buddhist Ideas.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.